From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in March when the White House announced an executive order pertaining to free speech on college campuses. President Trump signed the order directing federal agencies to link grants and other funding to free speech. In essence, the president wants the power to block funding for schools that block conservative speakers and ideas. He explained that he views college campuses as increasingly hostile to conservatives, but it's unclear exactly what's happening with that executive order and how it's going to be carried out. So this hour, we're going to go far beyond just that executive order. We're talking about the state of speech and learning on campus. The University of Rochester recently released a podcast on this subject, and in it, Professor David Primo explained why he's creating a new course called Disagreement in a Democratic Society. He says we've forgotten how to disagree well as a society. Do you agree? We're going to discuss the difference between speech or material that makes us uncomfortable or perhaps offended versus speech that makes us actually unsafe. Critics say too often we're leaping from uncomfortable to unsafe and trying to shut down anything that falls outside of our comfort zone. Defenders of so-called trigger warnings say that they're simply designed to give all students an opportunity to learn and engage. Free speech, trigger warnings, taking offense, and more. Let me welcome our guest for the hour. David Primo is the Annie and Mark Gabrillian Professor and Associate Professor of Political Science and Business Administration at the University of Rochester. That's a mouthful. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be back with you, Evan.
And we're hoping to welcome Matthew Burns, who's Dean of Students in Arts, Sciences, and Engineering at the University of Rochester, who also participated in the recent podcast. But Dean Burns is actually with students this hour. So we'll see if he can join us. But David, there's a lot to say on this subject, and I kind of want to just start with a broad look at how you view this. Do you view things as fundamentally different in 2019 than they were in 2015, 2010? I mean, have things changed in terms of the tenor of what is permissible on college campuses?
When I was an undergraduate, it was still the case that there were concerns about speech. There were concerns about whether speech itself can be harmful, whether speech itself can be violence. I mean, there's actually a pretty long literature in law and elsewhere talking about that concept. What I think has changed in the last 5 to 10 years is that we're beginning to institutionalize many of these concerns about speech. Concerns about speech codes, for instance, have always been present, but in the recent years, they seem to be getting a lot more attention, and students seem to be, at least a small share of students seem to be buying into this argument of speech as violence, and the phrase "how you experience somebody else's speech" has become sort of part of the nomenclature now in higher education. And so I do sense a change in that we're much less willing to engage with each other than we were, again, say 5, 10 years ago. Now, of course, we may always be viewing the past with rose-colored glasses. Things weren't always so great in the past either. But I do think it's something to be worried about. I don't think it's a crisis, but I do think it's something to be worried about.
At the core of this discussion, you'll notice that we'll talk a lot about what makes someone comfortable or uncomfortable, and whether that should be concern number one, or whether there's a window for real learning and idea sharing, even in spaces of discomfort. We'll talk about that coming up here in just a bit. But what do you say to those who would make the argument, look, if someone tells you they're offended, or if someone tells you they're hurt, or if someone tells you they're unsafe, then they are. That's not for you to judge. That's for them to judge.
I have a tremendous amount of respect for people's feelings. I mean, part of being an effective faculty member, I believe, is sort of gauging where students are and meeting them where they are. On the other hand, from the perspective of policymaking as a university or policymaking from a governmental perspective, it is very much a slippery slope to go down the road of saying how somebody experiences speech should define whether or not that speech is permissible. Because you can imagine that pretty much any controversial statement is going to offend somebody. And once you start opening the door toward offense being a justification for the prohibition of speech, you then very quickly get into the realm of censorship. And more importantly, from the perspective of an institution of higher education, you stifle learning and you stifle knowledge production.
I'm thinking of recent controversies, even in, for example, the young adult fiction world. The New York Times had the piece this week on a writer, 26-year-old writer named Amélie Zhao, whose book The Blood Heir is her debut work. And over the winter, some of the themes of the book were discussed with very few people actually having read it. And critics in the YA world immediately said, well, she's handling some very sensitive subjects insensitively. We want the book banned. We don't want it to be released. They hadn't even read it yet. But they didn't like what they were hearing, and she actually told her publisher, please pull it. They did, and then they reviewed the material, and she announced this past week they're going to go forward with the publication after review, and she does feel comfortable with it. But the interesting thing was, whether it was in the New York Times or on these other platforms, people were saying, well, how could you be criticizing a book that didn't even come out yet? And some of the critics said, I know enough about it to say that it was hurtful, and you ought to believe me when I say that it's hurtful. You don't get to decide if something is hurting me or not. I do. That's sort of the field. And it sounds like you're saying you respect that, but your concern is how far does that go? How far does that lead?
I would never deny somebody their feelings. If somebody feels hurt or they feel offended, they are hurt and they are offended. That's very different from saying, therefore, we should ban a book, or therefore, we should stop or stifle speech. To my mind, the correct way to handle a situation like that, and I'm not familiar with the details, speaking in general terms, is to say, you know, we find that the way this author handled these themes is insensitive or inappropriate. Let's have a discussion about it. Let's read the book and talk about why we think that this is an insensitive way to handle this topic. The solution almost never is to prohibit or ban. If anything, that draws more attention to the themes, and that creates its own set of problems.
And so what does it mean to disagree well? Because when you said on the University of Rochester podcast that you think we've sort of forgotten how to disagree well as a society. Tell me about that.
That concept of disagreeing well is one that I've been persuaded by in reading work and reading some other work by Arthur Brooks, who's the former head of the American Enterprise Institute, who recently came out with a book that deals with what he calls the culture of contempt. And the argument he's making is that we shouldn't disagree less as a society. We shouldn't always assume we're going to find common ground. In fact, that can be problematic. Instead, we should try to disagree better. We should try to understand that when we disagree with somebody, it doesn't negate their value as a human being. And I've found that to be a very persuasive way to think about sort of what's going on in society right now, where if we disagree with somebody, we tend to think, oh, this person, we disagree with this person, therefore they must be evil or fundamentally bad in some way. And that's a problem for the ability to disagree in a society. So I think this idea that we shouldn't try to always think we're going to find common ground, though that can be helpful. Instead, we should think, when we can't find common ground, at least can we understand the other person's perspective.
All right. In a moment, I'm going to welcome your colleague, Dean Burns, who's joining us here, on the subject of who decides how professors handle this. You discussed the notion that in some places, the idea is, well, an institution or university ought to have a policy on trigger warnings, for example, that, you know, on with material that's deemed sensitive, that professors are expected to offer warnings for students, et cetera. We could do a whole show on trigger warnings, I understand, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. But you dissented to that idea that there ought to be institutional policies on that. Why?
So I may get myself in trouble with my employer here, but I think the University of Rochester, like many universities, loves policies. They love policies. They love procedures. They think if you can write something down, you create a rule that somehow is going to sort of address the problem. And they've done it in lots of different realms. So it's not just the University of Rochester. And to their credit, they do not have a policy on trigger warnings, to my knowledge. I think these policies are a bad idea because they force faculty. They're essentially telling faculty members how it is they should go about educating. I may personally disagree with the concept of trigger warnings in a classroom, but I would be very loath to tell another faculty member how it is that they're going to run their class. And because once we start going down that road, we're going down a very slippery slope. Again, that slippery slope, it's common in speech type issues. We go down the slippery slope where we're controlling the content of what that professor is teaching. And that really cuts at academic freedom. It cuts at knowledge production. In general, we should always think twice about saying, do we need a policy for this?
Do you think on occasion trigger warnings are valid?
No. In fact, it's an example of a well-intentioned policy that was put in place or that some people have implemented without sufficient data to justify their use. So I do not deny the good intentions of people who advocate for trigger warnings. But if you actually look at the scientific research on, A, are trigger warnings effective? The answer is no. Are trigger warnings potentially harmful? I say potentially because we haven't established that really well scientifically. Yes, because they create this idea that that information should be traumatizing, and so it creates a self-fulfilling prophecy potentially, and creates this long-term sort of coddling of students. So there's the potential for long-term harm. There's no evidence of short-run benefit, and there's a literature in psychology saying that if you've experienced a traumatic incident, sort of not dealing with it is exactly the wrong response. Now, I'm not a psychologist, so I'm basing this on my reading of the literature on this subject, but it's not obvious. You know, those who advocate for trigger warnings make the claim, if you don't agree with the concept of trigger warnings, I saw one person post recently, you know, you must be stupid. Not to me, to somebody else. And that's sort of the example of right how we need to disagree better as a society.
All right, well, but one more question for you before I bring in your colleague on that then. I'm sure someone listening to this program would like to call and say that you must be stupid for that, because when we've talked about these and related subjects, it gets pretty heated. And I want to ask you if you feel, not that you're at all unsafe, but do you feel that the rhetoric that whether it's in activism circles or elsewhere, that it could come for you, that when you speak out against the idea of trigger warnings, is there sort of a social or sort of any sort of educational risk for you in your role here at the University of Rochester?
I would hope not.
Okay.
I would hope not. But it's always been my belief that the way to deal with that sort of those sorts of attacks is to stick to the facts, to stick to the empirical reality. So if you could show me a set of studies that these trigger warnings actually are beneficial, and it might be useful to at some point unpack exactly what do we mean by a trigger warning, but to actually unpack whether these are useful, if you can show me a set of studies that establishes that, that would be wonderful. But I worry that trigger warnings are part of a larger phenomenon in college campuses where we put into place these, not so much policies, but we put into place programs or beliefs that aren't tested, that there's no empirical evidence to support them, but universities feel the need to support them because they have to show they're doing something. And so we have a lot of this in other areas as well.
All right, let me bring in Matthew Burns, the Dean of Students in Arts, Sciences, and Engineering at the University of Rochester, who also participated in that recent podcast. Nice to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to ask you, right, we'll just get right into trigger warnings because this may be a point of at least some mild disagreement. Mm-hmm. Let me just start by asking you the same question I asked your colleague. Do you see instances where trigger warnings would be appropriate or effective?
Well, I think there's certainly an area where Dave and I agree, and that's that I don't think there should be a policy mandating trigger warnings. On the other hand, in the subject of human discourse and the emotions that we have toward one another, I think that they are valid, and I think an instructor can see the value in that. Like, we're about to discuss this difficult concept, right? And it's more than coddling. I think it's an appreciation of the fact that some of the information presented may trigger emotions in people that have had traumatic experiences in their past. And for those individuals, learning shuts down. So where Dave and I agree wholeheartedly is that, you know, you need conflict in order to learn, right? There's always conflict that I want to learn something that I don't know about, that I'm addressing a point of view that I've never heard before that I might disagree with, and we need to do that civilly. But for some students, these issues shut learning down. And trigger warnings have value in that discourse. So it's difficult to know, you know, when to have them, when to not have them. And that's the reason why I think we don't need a policy about them. But a specific professor in a specific class where you know that this subject matter is likely to impact someone, I think some fair warning is justified. And I think it's up to the individual instructor. Now, I think a guidance is different than a policy. So as we learn more and more about this stuff, and we learn more about pedagogy, I think we have to study where is it appropriate and where is it not. But to dismiss them as totally irrelevant to the classroom, or on the other hand, to say we need a policy governing when they're happening in the classroom, I think both of those points of view I see as extreme.
Yeah, and so Matt, just to kind of follow that point, what I hear from your colleague is not that that some students haven't had trauma and might potentially benefit. He's saying he doesn't see a lot of data that backs it up.
Right.
That better research or more data before actually undergoing these kind of changes in approach in the classroom would be helpful. And the concern is, let's say there is a non-zero number of students who really have suffered trauma who would benefit from trigger warnings. We don't know what that number is, but it's right. Not zero. The concern I think I hear from David and I hear from critics of trigger warnings is, in the effort to help that non-zero population, you are teaching a broader population that has not endured trauma that they have, or that they are fragile and could break if they encounter ideas that might make them uncomfortable, and that it actually has a deleterious effect. Is there any currency to that argument for you?
I don't know. If I were teaching a course and I were about to talk about some...
And Matt, I'm just going to give you the same instruction I gave David. Get right on that microphone for me.
Oh, okay.
There.
If I were an instructor about to talk about an incident that involved a forcible rape, for instance,
yeah.
I see no deleterious effect by saying up front, we're about to cover some really serious subject matter here, and it's about this before we get into it. And I don't know that that's coddling anyone. Is it coddling someone on TV to see that, you know, this is a difficult subject and parent guidance is warranted? I don't know that that coddles anyone. It just gives people fair warning. And if somebody in that room, that non-zero person, did suffer a traumatic incident associated with that subject matter, then I would want that person to have fair warning that we're about to enter into that.
Okay, well, here's a comment from a listener on Twitter, and Professor Primo, this listener says, a big modifier is what group you fall into and what risk you run of being legitimately unsafe. If you benefit from privilege, you probably shouldn't also be the one gatekeeping. Let people of color, LGBTQ, any marginalized populations decide what makes them feel unsafe. What do you say to that?
So, again, I don't deny anybody their feelings, but this idea of what makes people feel unsafe. So now we've introduced a new word, right? Before we were talking about whether people feel uncomfortable. Now we're introducing the word unsafe. And there we get into a really delicate area, which is if somebody feels unsafe because of speech, that at what point does that become actionable? In other words, where you would stop permitting that sort of speech. Again, we're going down a slippery slope because a discussion, for instance, of bans on immigration, let's say, is that something that should make somebody who's a dreamer, and I've had dreamers in my classes, should that make somebody who's a dreamer feel unsafe? Or let's say it makes them feel unsafe. Does that mean that conversation should not happen? That's where we go down a very slippery slope. I think the solution is for the individuals who feel unsafe in context to speak up and to have a conversation about that, not to say, I feel unsafe, therefore this conversation needs to stop. Now, if there's an overt threat of violence, that's a very different category of speech.
So you're not saying there's nothing that you would shut down, but it sounds like it's a pretty small subset.
A direct threat,
yeah.
Right? A
direct threat.
Right. But the discussion of racism, the discussion of immigration policy, right? Once you start shutting that down, you shut down conversation. And I worry very deeply about that for what it means for higher education and what it means for society. And again, it's not to deny that people may feel very uncomfortable by certain kinds of speech. But who makes the decision? Again, speaking back to the listener's comment about who are the gatekeepers, my point is that there shouldn't be much gatekeeping going on. The gatekeeping should be very, very limited to situations that would clearly fall under a threat of violence. not the experience of something. That's a phrase that I've seen pop up a lot in popular discourse lately, how somebody experiences speech. And it's not to deny their feelings, but from the perspective of a free society, it's very dangerous when we start making policy on the basis of people's experiencing of speech.
Okay, and so before I turn to Matt for his take on that, I want to just make sure we understand the distinction you're drawing, a direct threat, something that you would stop, versus just about everything else. And to me, what that says is, I'm going to make an assumption, you tell me if I'm right, that too often we are making a leap from, I feel uncomfortable with this, to, it makes me unsafe. I am not safe. It should be stopped. Do you think we're making a leap too often there?
Yes. Absolutely. And I should note that it's not that here's the thing, though. I actually, you know, when I interact with my students, so there's what we read in the media, there's what we read in the press, but my students in 17 years of teaching, and maybe it's the subject matter I teach in political economy, but we dealt with sweatshops this semester, we've dealt with issues of colonialism this semester. Not once, never have I had a student privately or publicly say that we shouldn't have this conversation. So when we discussed sweatshop, we had a conversation, said, let's ask the question, right? If you are living in an impoverished society, is it the case that child labor is always bad? And now, of course, I have my own opinions on that. But the point is that that's not just an abstract conversation for people who live in a developing country where the choice might be to have their children work or to starve. And the students dealt with that in a really impressive way, and they push back and they're engaged. So I don't want to create the impression for the listeners that students are this fragile group of people. But at the same time, I am worried that a small but vocal group of students and administrators and faculty are creating this impression that to be uncomfortable is to be unsafe. The word unsafe has become so overused that it's lost a lot of its meaning.
Agree or disagree, Matt?
I think that's the subject of discourse right now. So if I had to weigh in, I would say I agree that unsafe and uncomfortable are becoming terms that are used equally, and they ought not to be, because there are definitions of free expression and free speech, right? I think the argument about to speak to the listener's comment about the gatekeeping is that when you feel uncomfortable in a classroom, you are not likely to speak up against the discourse that's going on. And so it becomes a vicious circle, right? But that's not really, it's not practical, and I don't think it's reasonable to expect that every classroom is going to be monitored, the speech in every classroom is going to be monitored by marginalized groups. That just, I can't see a policy or even a process or a practice that follows that. So I agree with Dave in that I think we are conflating what's uncomfortable with what's unsafe sometimes, but I also think there's a legitimate argument out there that needs to be dealt with that, no, when I go into a classroom and I constantly see white men teaching me and we're discussing uncomfortable concepts, I'm not always comfortable speaking my mind or speaking up against that. And I might go to other places to speak out against that to find some recourse. And we just haven't found a balance for that yet.
But is the balance stopping certain speech or how about a couple of things? And I'm just sort of thinking out loud here. Number one, we should have more diversity in the classroom in terms of faculty. And we see that at the public school level, K-12, and we see that at higher ed. We don't have a lot of diversity. And I know everyone says they're trying, but we could do better there. But also, how about instead of stopping speech, do we create a culture that says, that really starts with the leadership of every single person who's teaching a class, saying, if you are uncomfortable, I want you to raise your voice, not to silence it. I want you to feel welcome. I want to engage. I want us all to know that we're going to grapple with things that might challenge us. And instead of sort of maybe not offering, and I don't know what most professors, I've taught one college class in my lifetime, but is it a cultural change needed? Is it a change in the diversity of faculty? Or is it, hey, we should probably be snuffing out a little bit more of the things that make people uncomfortable?
Well,
or maybe that's a false choice. I don't know.
No, I think what you're suggesting is great. To start a class by saying that is wonderful. But I think it needs part two of that. And part two is this, that if for whatever reason you're uncomfortable speaking to me about that, then you can go here, and wherever here is, a bias-related incident or some other administrator or some sort of other person. You know, I can't know everything as an instructor, right? So even if we had the most diverse faculty in the nation, we wouldn't always get to that point, right? And not every instructor is going to represent every marginalized group. And so there has to be a part two to that. I'm open to that. I want to hear that feedback. If it makes you uncomfortable or if you feel silenced or I shut down learning in some way, I want to know about that. And if you're uncomfortable talking to me, then talk to this other person or other system of providing that feedback, which will eventually get back to me. And I welcome it because what I want, what we all want, is for me to be the best instructor I can be.
Okay. I, you know, when I teach my classes, I, from day one, try to set the tone that disagreeing with me is perfectly acceptable, in fact, encouraged in class. Respectful disagreement among students is encouraged in class. And I asked students in a survey I gave them at the beginning of class that they could or could not answer, is up to them, whether they've ever felt uncomfortable expressing their opinion. Here's the interesting thing. I had a handful of students, not a huge majority, so I don't want to create the impression this is all students, who said, you know, I'm going to paraphrase here to protect the anonymity of students. I'm white, and so I don't feel comfortable commenting on issues of race because I haven't, you know, been somebody who's African American, so I can't speak or understand what it's like. So I can't feel like I can contribute to that conversation. And I hope listeners can sort of get why that's problematic. Right, because how can we advance race relations in the country? How can we deal with the difficult subject of race if a large sector of people feel like they can't, or some sector of the population feels like they can't contribute to that conversation because they haven't obviously experienced being African American, and that's troubling to me. That's as concerning to me as an African American student says, I don't feel comfortable speaking out about racism in class. That also is problematic, but I think both of those are problematic because if either of those students feels uncomfortable speaking out, how are we going to have a meaningful conversation?
Yeah, I think my instinct is I probably, if I were teaching, don't know that I would find them equally problematic, only because minority voices have for so long either been left out or felt left out. I don't want anyone to feel uncomfortable to the point where they don't contribute, but I take the larger point here that linking discomfort to sort of withdrawing or, you know, a higher level of unsafe is a leap that's too far here. Okay. Listeners, I want to hear from you on this. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. And when we come back from our only break of the hour, I want to ask our guests briefly what they think about what they heard from the White House and the executive order. The president, Matt's looking at me going, great. Yeah, I know what that smile says. Thank you for that. No, it's, you know, what the president is saying is he feels like conservative ideas are under assault. My concern just observing what the president's executive order is, apart from the fact that it's sort of nebulous and hard to define how you would execute it, it's similar to my concern about whether it's Pete Buttigieg or others who are talking about expanding the Supreme Court. If you want to expand the Supreme Court, I hope you want to do it even if you have the advantage. If you want to sort of crack down on speech on campus, I hope you do it if the speech that you don't like is under threat here. And sometimes I feel like politically we take the cudgel when we see an advantage as opposed to looking at it a little bit more of an egalitarian mindset. Let's get that only break of the hour, and we'll come back and continue the conversation. We'll hear from you as well next. Coming up in our second hour, Americans eat more, we exercise less, we're outside less often than just about ever before, and we exercise a lot less than most other countries in the world. But there is one activity that is slowly on the rise, according to the New York Times, adventure bicycling. You're going to hear some wild stories from the road, and we'll tell you about opportunities here in Rochester. If you want to take part and share your stories as well, next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The University of Rochester has been putting out a series of podcasts that I think have sparked some really interesting and important discussions, and we appreciate that. And we'll make sure that we link to this particular podcast, which is the basis for this conversation this hour with David Primo, who is professor of political science and business administration at the University of Rochester, and Matthew Burns, dean of students in arts, sciences, and engineering at the U of R. And Matt, I joked before our break that you were giving me that look that said, don't drag me into this. But do you think with the White House and this executive order on speech on campus, do you think it has much meaning?
No, I actually think it has no meaning whatsoever.
Why
it doesn't
that?
Further the discourse. It doesn't define free speech any more than we already have. I think it's blustering, which is what I would have expected.
Blustering. Okay. Yes. David.
I have two separate thoughts on the executive order. From a policy perspective, it's a disaster. Just as I'm not a big fan of universities making policies with regard to speech on campus, I'm even less of a fan of the federal government doing it. That would be true whether Donald Trump is president, Barack Obama is president. The government should not be in the business of speech. That said, this is sort of the peril for universities who accept a lot of federal dollars, right? You run the risk that the federal government is going to say, hey, as a condition of getting all of this money from us, you're going to have to march to the beat of our drummer. So that should just give all of us pause about just how much we want the federal government involved in higher education. Because once they control the purse strings, they can try to tie in other factors that we may not like. And so that's the second piece. The third piece, so I guess I said two, now it's actually three, is that as with some of the things that the president says, there's an underlying germ of truth that he then sort of overlays lots of untruths on top of. And that is the idea that certain ideas are disfavored on college campuses. Certain ideas, especially controversial ideas, are faculty members sometimes are encouraged not to pursue them. I've been encouraged at my university by certain people not to pursue certain lines of research because they're viewed as controversial.
My job is to ask you what lines of research.
I've been encouraged pretty much since I arrived not to pursue the research I do on campaign finance. It reaches conclusions that are at odds with the conventional wisdom that money everywhere and always is evil. And I've been encouraged, subtly and not so subtly, to not do that research. I haven't listened because I view that research as fundamentally important and crucial to the foundation of what it means for me to be a scholar.
You got a book coming out on it.
I do. Yeah, with the University of Chicago Press later, probably early 2020.
On campaign finance, Citizens United, et cetera?
Yes, exactly.
All right.
And that's a book that I was encouraged not to pursue.
I hope you'll come back on this program and talk about it.
Absolutely.
Okay, interesting. Let me get some feedback from listeners. Maggie in Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Maggie.
Hi. So I teach sociology, which is a subject that is sort of notorious for this, like, trigger warning, difficulty in the classroom kind of situation. And the first thing I'd like to say is that there's more than one way to skin a cat. Right? So you can give students notice that you're going to be discussing something that's potentially difficult or upsetting without using the phrase trigger warning, and therefore setting them up for this idea that what they're about to hear is something that should be emotionally difficult or volatile. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, we're going to talk about something that's difficult today. I also think that there are ways to do so without expecting people who have gone through traumatic incidences to out themselves, right? So if we say, we're going to watch something that's about forcible rape in a minute, and if you're uncomfortable with that, then you can get up and leave right now in front of everyone. What you're actually asking rape survivors to do is out themselves in front of their classmates. And so what I tend to do is give a break. I say, we're going to take a 5-minute break, and if you want to watch the film, be here when we get back, right? That way people don't have to stand up in a silent, oh, sorry, honey, my little daughter's here, sorry. Go inside, right, in a silent classroom, right? And do those things. But I also think I really, really disagree with the idea that giving people warning about discussing difficult topics in the classroom is coddling them. No person works through their trauma effectively in front of 50 strangers, right? That's not how that works. And so this idea that somehow giving people the ability to take care of their own mental health is coddling them is deeply problematic. And I'd also, I know I'm a rambler, but I'd just like to point out, too, that all, hang on 1 second, honey, okay? I'd also just like to point out that of all of the students, here, give these keys to Daddy. Here you go, give them those. That of all of the students that I've had who have objected to the content of my courses, it's actually much more often been non-minority students, right, who do feel like they can't discuss race or these things. I've actually seen my minority students much more willing to sort of get into the nitty-gritty and have conversations that are difficult for them than I have students who are not accustomed to being in a situation where they're discussing things like white privilege or rape on campus or those other subjects that get under their skin.
So,
I think that it's... Go ahead.
I just want to, at the risk of offending your daughter, I have a follow-up question for you. and I'm really glad you called. I want to ask a question in good faith here because I don't know the answer. But the often invoked idea of trigger warnings is about things like sexual assault, forcible rape, which I certainly understand.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to ask is, you know, you pose this idea that if you're showing a film, maybe you take a break, you give students a chance not to watch it. But if you're if you're teaching and grading based on a book or a film, a play, an article that references or kind of explores these subjects, whether it's forcible rape or otherwise, and the students are going to be graded on that, what happens for a student who takes themselves out of that material? And what do you give them a separate lesson elsewhere? How do you deal with that?
So I was super unclear, and I appreciate you
helping me
clarify that. I don't give them the option to not watch it. I give them the option to not watch it in a room full of other people.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right? So they're still expected to engage with the material. But I don't expect students to, like, I don't know if you've ever seen the documentary 13th, right? It's a Netflix documentary. It's about the history of the prison industrial complex. And it ends with a sort of montage of Black people, unarmed Black people being killed by police. Right. I don't necessarily expect my students of color to sit and watch that in a classroom with other people. I think that if that's something that people want to watch on their own, if we're watching a documentary about campus rape and people don't want to watch that in a room full of other people, or I show a documentary about gun violence, right, they're still expected to watch it. But the idea that somehow it's coddling people to say, I want you to go through your trauma, I want you to go through this traumatic experience, basically on stage, right, in front of other people. And it is your responsibility to regulate your emotional reaction to that in front of all of these other people and then on the spot have a conversation about it. I don't think that that's necessarily compassionate or reasonable. And it doesn't mean that students, there's, again, like this idea that there's this either or, right, that students don't engage with this stuff or they do it in front of 50 to 100 people. We're educators. We're supposed to be more creative than that, right? And we're supposed to be accounting for the needs of every person in our classroom. And so I don't offer alternate assignments unless somebody comes to me and says, you know, I really can't do this. I really can't watch this, right? Then maybe there's some other medium in which they could engage with the material. But I think that some of this stuff are manufactured crises in terms of this crisis of communication on campus. Just be more creative in how you approach these issues. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I appreciate you taking the time to call, Maggie. Thank you very much. I'll start with Professor Primo. Go ahead.
There's no doubt in my mind that you want to work with students. You want to meet them where they're at. And the issue I have with the concept of trigger warnings is, again, what the scientific literature so far tells us, which is that you actually may be doing some harm by, or at the very least not helping, but you actually may be doing some harm in the use of these trigger warnings.
Okay, and when Maggie is posing this idea that a sexual assault survivor would just be given that opportunity to watch material elsewhere, not to sort of almost performatively deal with trauma. Does that carry weight with you?
That strikes me as a perfectly reasonable accommodation, but that's even there, again, I would go back to, I'm not a psychologist, so this is not my area of expertise, but nor are 99% of the or 95% of the faculty members who are making this argument. So I think we need to have a better discussion about exactly how and when those sorts of accommodations should be made. So I don't, to be clear, right, I'm not saying they should never be made or that these are always a bad idea. What I'm saying is that in general, there's not a lot of evidence to say they're beneficial. So maybe all of us need, we need more research, we need more education about when and where they are effective. But I just want to give you one example, though, of how we can go from something like sexual assault survivor, which you can very much imagine a really good rationale for why you'd want to have a trigger warning, even if in the end the research says it's not such a great idea.
Sure,
you can,
sure.
To this, let me just read you something very quickly. So some students who are religiously conservative have said that they need to have, that in parents have complained to having nude models in studio courses, to the discussion of homoerotic content in art history. So there's an example. Now, if you support the general concept of trigger warning, so put aside the more complicated case of a sexual assault survivor, just the discussion of racism, right, or the discussion of colonialism, right? If you think all of these subjects need trigger warnings, then should we have trigger warnings for homoerotic art in art history class? I would say no to all of these, but if you're going to support it in some cases, where do you start? Where do you draw the line? And that's where it gets complicated for me.
Okay. Matt, what do you think?
Well, I mean, it's really Dave's area to talk more about the classroom than mine. I think that our caller had some perfectly reasonable ideas about this. To Dave's point about, you know, where do you draw the line, that's always the question with free speech, right? I think, and I'm not sure, I haven't seen the research that Dave has. I wonder, though, if that's research in the aggregate for everyone or if it's those students who would need and benefit from trigger warnings. Has research been done on those students? So I think we do need to look at the research, and my guess is that we haven't done enough of it to really understand what the impact of trigger warnings are. But I think that there are some cases that are really clear, like a sexual assault survivor in a classroom where there's a film that shows a forcible rape. I think anybody who is reasonable can see why a trigger warning might be beneficial there. To Dave's point, though, about the homoerotic art or conservative Christian values, it's usually what comes up. Should there be trigger warnings there? You know, that is the slippery slope. I guess as a professor, I could decide, sure, I'll give trigger warnings to everything, but and I'm opposed to their being mandated in any situation, but it is unclear. You know, I think, no, I'm inclined to agree with Dave that, no, not everything that makes you uncomfortable needs a warning. I don't know where to draw the line, though, so I guess that's where I weigh in. My answer is I don't know.
Okay. Tony in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Tony.
Oh, hi. Very interesting conversation, and I really feel like the people are being thoughtful in the discussion. Personally, you know, I don't believe in intellectually safe spaces. I don't think that does students any good, that they need to be able to respond and defend their positions. As far as the trigger warning goes, I feel like if a professor wants to give trigger warnings, that's perfectly fine. And that's not the kind of coddling aspect of it. But I think one of your guests kind of hit on it. It's the sense of entitlement to a trigger warning that perhaps is a coddling of a student, that somehow that they feel that's required before they can enter into a discussion. And how could that possibly prepare them intellectually to make arguments and defend their positions? So that's my problem with, I have no problem with someone who thinks you need a trigger warning, perfectly fine. I think the idea of giving people breaks so that they can absent themselves from this disturbing things that are problematic for them, also fine. You know, professors in a classroom, there's a power dynamic there. And students don't have a choice in many cases. So you got to find some way, and I think that idea of giving someone a break is a great way to give them that choice. But the sense of entitlement, that's the problem. And that's where we begin to impinge on free speech. So that's my feeling.
All right, Tony, thank you for that. And Tony's phone call reminds me that in the University of Rochester podcast, David, you were making the point that feeling of discomfort students have or feeling of being uncomfortable is actually not something to stamp out. You view that as a window to learning.
Absolutely. I think you should be comfortable in the classroom to express your opinions, but you should be prepared to be have experienced discomfort or be uncomfortable in hearing the opinions of others, because that's how you learn. And so I gave the example in the podcast of this panel I held on globalization, where I invited somebody who is very much in favor of the Trump tariffs and referred to him as sort of an economic nationalist. And I thought it was important for students to hear an articulate defense of President Trump's trade policies. And a student went up to this individual after the panel and said, you know, we don't hear that kind of perspective expressed very often on this campus. And that's the mindset I'm trying to change at the University of Rochester. A student emailed me recently and said to me, you know, I wish the University of Rochester celebrated resilience as much as we celebrate respect and responsibility. This isn't summer camp. And that's coming from a student. So I actually give the students a lot of credit. I love teaching undergraduates. And part of it is that that 95, 96, maybe more percent of them want to learn. They want to engage with ideas. And so I worry that a small minority of students is creating this larger problem for college campuses when the majority of students want to learn. And again, I want to be clear that not thinking that trigger warnings are in general a good idea is not to say that we shouldn't be sensitive to the needs of our students. Students confide in me all sorts of things going on in their lives. And in fact, I do think that faculty members need to do a better job of understanding that students have a lot going on in their lives. Some of them may be dreamers. They may be worried about deportation. Others may be on a very low income. Others may have dealt with a trauma recently in their life of all sorts. And being sensitive to that that's not about trigger warnings. That's just about being a decent human being.
But let's say you are a dreamer. The day after the election in 2016, some campuses had mental health counselors for students to deal with the election results. Was that appropriate?
No. And I actually spoke out against the University of Rochester's handling of that in my classroom. The day after the election, I said, some of you probably found this election to be profoundly disturbing. Others of you may be celebrating right now. Regardless, we're here to learn. We've got a job to do, and we need to move on. Now, in fairness to the students, I actually think some of the university officials were more traumatized by President Trump's election than the students were. In fact, one student I saw in the hallway the day after the election said to me, I'm going to fight this. You know, we are not going to stand for this man being president. We are going to advocate. We are going to get it. You know, we are going to, we're going to protest. And I said, good for you. That's exactly how you should be reacting to this, saying what can we do now to deal with the reality as we see it? But I would make the parallel that if Hillary Clinton had won the election, we would not see notes being sent out from the president of the university saying, you know, I extend a hand in friendship to you because Hillary Clinton has been elected.
Matt, was it inappropriate and a mistake for the University of Rochester to handle that election that way?
It might have been. I think our students in their reaction were entirely appropriate. I agree with Dave. My students astound me on a regular basis. They respond to really difficult issues very, very well. And I think Dave is absolutely right. It goes without question in my mind that if Hillary Clinton had won that election, we wouldn't have reacted the same way. And I also agree with him in terms of looking around at the faculty and staff versus the students and who is traumatized more by that election. I would agree with his perspective there, too. So I think our students' reaction to that, in fact, there was a protest, right, there shortly after that. And the protest went really well, except for non-students who were at the protest. That was the only problem with it. So in this case, yes, I think Dave is right that perhaps we jumped the gun on that, right? My point of view is let's wait and see. You know, if the students are asking for that, then certainly. But jumping the gun and saying you need it, that speaks directly to what Dave is saying. And this whole program, I've disagreed with him on some occasions with that. But in this case, yes, you know, we follow the students in that case. And we should have followed the students in that case. We shouldn't have jumped the gun and said, you need to be traumatized over this.
About a minute left here, and Professor Primo, you said that you're going to be teaching a new course called Disagreement in a Democratic Society. What's it going to entail?
That's right. Spring 2020, a seminar course where we look into the psychology of disagreement, how we disagree, look into disagreement in political spheres, so political polarization, and also look at and how we how disagreement is an important function for universities. So it's going to be a multidisciplinary course, sort of dealing with all aspects of the concept of disagreement and why it's important for a free society.
And do you find that... Well, I guess I'll just ask, given what you've said about your book and your other research, any discouragement that you've had from your colleagues about teaching that course?
No. This has been all clear.
Okay. And to put just an important point on this discussion as we close it, what I haven't heard from our guests is an agreement with some of the caricature of college campuses where all students are soft and blah, blah, blah. You know some of the caricatures that are out there. You don't feel that way, do you?
No. In fact, I am... We have only a couple seconds left, so I'll be very quick. What infuriates me is not when people from the outside criticize students. So they're not on college campuses, yeah. They're just creating caricatures. But I actually am very concerned when faculty members disparage students and complain about students. It is a privilege to be teaching on a college campus. It is a privilege to be having the opportunity to shape the future of our society, and you need to engage with students, not treat them as nuisances.
I hope you listen to the podcast that Matt and David helped create there, and we'll link to it. And I want to thank our guests for taking the time to come in here. And Dean Burns, I know it's been a busy afternoon. Thank you for squeezing in, and thank you for being here and sharing your time.
Sure, thank you.
And our thanks to Professor David Primo as well. Thank you for taking the time to be here.
Thank you.
All right, short break, more connections coming up.